This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran in for Ron Ropiak. On June 13th, New York lawmakers voted to end religious exemptions for mandatory vaccinations. Governor Andrew Cuomo said the decision was made to stem a recent spike in the number of measles cases in the state. Two lawsuits have been filed to stay the repeal. As the new school year begins, what will happen to children with exemptions? Elizabeth Vespi is a reporter for 27 East. She joins me now. Elizabeth, welcome to The Full Story.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Tell us about the new rules and what parents need to do to comply.
Okay, so as everybody knows, on June 13th, Governor Cuomo signed this into legislation stopping the religious exemptions on vaccinations. So as the new school year begins, students will have 14 days after the first day of school in September to get those first immunizations, according to the new law. And hold on one second. And after, within 30 days of the first day of attendance, the children must show the administrators that they have the age-appropriate appointment scheduled for the next follow-up doses to complete the rest of the mandatory immunizations in the series.
So they have to prove that they've had it and also that they've got the booster scheduled.
Right, correct.
How many children are we talking about that will be impacted by the new law in the state?
So in New York State as a whole, they're saying it is 26,000 students. That's what the New York State Department of Health is saying. And in Suffolk County, it is just under 3,000 students being affected. The exact number in Suffolk County on Long Island is 2,778 students that won't be allowed to go to school come September. And in Nassau County, also on Long Island, the number is 1,604 students who won't be allowed to go into school.
So we're talking about a fairly sizable population here.
Yes, definitely.
You attended
So I was just going to go into what you were going to ask about the Sag Harbor School Board meeting.
Yes, there was one recently that was a regularly scheduled board meeting, but it took a turn. Tell me about that.
Right, so it was the board's regularly scheduled goals meeting where they set their goals for the upcoming school year. And in the beginning, there's a public portion where parents are able to air their concerns and all that kind of stuff. And probably about 10 parents or so showed up, some with their children, and spoke of the new legislation, asking superintendent of the Sag Harbor School District, Katie Graves, to write a letter regarding the preliminary injunction request to Justice Denise Hartman.
Before we get to Katie Graves, let's backtrack a little bit and talk about this meeting as then all of a sudden these 10 individuals show up. What was the reaction to members of the board and people in the room?
The members of the board actually seemed to be swayed with the way the parents were speaking, because clearly the parents just want what's best for their kids. And they were all very heartfelt about it. And their main concern was not really with the vaccinations. It was with the fact that the new law is, in a way, taking away their religious freedom, because the law states that it's taking away the religious exemption. So that was the main concern of the majority of the parents, that it's taking away their religious freedom.
I know you had mentioned that it wasn't just one religion, that you were surprised by the people and the religious affiliations that they were mentioning as wanting to take this exemption.
Right, because originally the law was put into effect because of the measles outbreak, which happened primarily in New York City and Rockland County, and that all through the media was brought back to the Orthodox Jewish community. So I always thought it was something within the Orthodox Jewish community, but there are other religions that people follow, other Orthodox religions that also say vaccinations are against their religion. which I was surprised to see. And I feel like a lot of the board members were surprised to hear about that, too.
Let's talk a little bit about Superintendent Katie Graves. So the request went out to her that she write a letter to several state officials. What did those that were requesting this, what did they want the letter to say?
They basically wanted the letter to ask the state to not implement the new legislation so rapidly. So as this went into effect on June 13th, kids that were already in summer school had to have their first round of shots by June 28th. So for kids in summer school and in summer programs, it is pretty rapid to ask. It's signed in on June 13th to ask them to get vaccines or decide what else to do before June 28th. It's pretty rapid because some of these parents are going to probably look into homeschool, maybe private school out of the state, or even considering moving out of state if they, because of their deeply held religious convictions, they may even consider moving out of state to not vaccinate their children at all. So,
did she go ahead and write that letter?
So the board, after about 2.5 hours of back and forth at the meeting, agreed to send a letter to state representatives. And the following day, which was a Tuesday, the superintendent called me and said she wouldn't be able to write that letter because the lawyers at the school advised her not to, for the reason that there are kids enrolled in the district that have medical problems where they're unable to get vaccinations. So if unvaccinated kids are allowed to go into the school and they have that paper record of Katie Graves asking for the unvaccinated kids to be able to still be enrolled in school, that itself could be a liability if those kids with medical problems were to get sick from the unvaccinated kids.
So in other words, she was advised that she has to think of the district at large.
Right.
All right, so what are schools now doing, to prepare for the new rules?
I'm not really sure if schools are doing that much from what I've heard around, but I know there have been a lot of homeschool meetings, and a lot of these parents have been attending meetings about entering their kids into homeschooling. Like last night, I attended one of those meetings. And there were probably about 20 parents in the crowd. And just for, like, to get a grasp of how many people in Sag Harbor will be affected by this, they're saying about 35 students. So that's 35 out of 1,000 students. Well, 35 out of 950 students in the district. So that's a pretty big number in a small district. So a lot of those parents are considering homeschooling their kids and taking their kids out of school completely.
But
September.
That creates an entire shift in some families, especially if both parents work, doesn't it?
Right. Yes. A lot of parents were saying how that's going to be a financial hardship, especially for local parents who both they need both incomes to survive.
So that's definitely
going to be a hardship.
So for the students who do not get vaccinated beyond the medical exemption, and they won't be allowed at this stage to attend school. This goes beyond just the classroom, doesn't it?
Right. So these students also, they won't be able to join sport teams or do other extracurricular activities in the school. So it kind of goes outside of the classroom. It kind of goes towards if the student wanted to join a sports team that is with the school, they won't be allowed to do that, or extracurricular activities and all that kind of stuff, or clubs at the school. They're not going to be able to partake in any of those either.
I know yesterday a judge made a ruling on this. There was a filing for an injunction so that the religious exemption remains in place. But what was that ruling?
So there hasn't been, it's still being delayed. There hasn't been a decision finally made as to whether kids will be able to go to school in September. They're still awaiting a decision on that, if they'll be able to get an injunction and delay the law from going into action.
I know your article that you wrote on this also gave us some background on how deadly these diseases are. We don't really today, because it's been quite some time since the 1960s, that we don't recognize, because we don't see it, how deadly the disease is, the potential of widespread disease they can create and have. Tell us a little bit about that research.
Oh, yes. So according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and this was in 1964, an epidemic of rubella infected 12.5 million Americans, and it ended up killing 2,000 babies and caused 11,000 miscarriages. And that's according to the CDC. And since 2012, only 15 cases of rubella have been reported to the CDC. So you can see since vaccinations have been implemented, it's gone down drastically.
And that's just one example of one disease, right?
That's another type of measles, rubella, German measles. So before the measles vaccination, which started in 1963, about 3 to 4 million people got measles each year in the United States. And that, again, is from the CDC. I'm just reading what I wrote. Of those, approximately 500,000 cases were reported each year to the CDC. And of those, 400 to 500 people died, with 48,000 being hospitalized.
So the potential is there for some widespread infection. Elizabeth Vespe, thank you so much for joining us today on The Full Story from 27 East.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Have a good day. This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran. We continue our conversation on the impact New York's repeal of the vaccine exemptions will have on students as they begin the 2019 school year. Well, New York is not the first state to repeal religious exemptions. California repealed its exemptions about 3 years ago. Joining us now is Dr. Lisa Ward. She is the immediate past president of the California Academy of Family Physicians. Dr. Ward, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give us a little piece of history. Why did California decide to remove the religious exemptions for vaccines in schools?
We found, looking at vaccine rates across the state, that there were many schools that had children attending them where the vaccine rate was not high enough to provide what we call a herd immunity, meaning that children were protected from contagious diseases whether or not they were vaccinated, because there were so many children that lacked the vaccines to keep them from getting the illness. Essentially, they could spread disease in school. And so one of the main intentions of our efforts with our Senate bills was to narrow the number of exemptions for children opting out of vaccines in a really intentional effort to try to raise vaccine rates among children.
And what was the reaction of parents in the state?
The reaction was mixed, and this is an intense issue for parents. There were parents on one end of the spectrum who have children with significant immune compromise whose children's lives depend on this herd immunity to protect their child, because their child cannot get vaccines. In the middle, there are parents who have concerns about vaccines, asked questions, got educated, and felt comfortable. And on the other end of the spectrum, there are also parents who have very significant concerns about the content of vaccines, unintended consequences of vaccines, and vaccine safety, who have very intense feelings about not vaccinating their children. So it was a real spectrum of reaction.
California is different from New York in the fact that my understanding is that California allowed 2 years for this transition to take place. Why did the state choose a two-year window, and how was it implemented over this time period?
I think that officials from the Department of Health know much more about this, but in the high level, what my experience was as a physician was that our Department of Health came to physician practices, medical practices, to try to educate us about what the process would be, what the criteria were. There was a significant campaign in the to patients and to the public so that they could understand what the requirements were. And really importantly, we needed that ramp-up time to help schools be able to understand and implement these new processes. So really, I think the intention of this ramp-up time was to educate us all so we could get the system changed.
And as we look back on 2018-19, we've seen this 25-year spike in the number of measles cases. What have you seen in California with regard to cases of measles having removed the religious exemption? Is there a correlation there at all? Has there been an impact?
Well, what we really saw when we compare, for example, kindergarten children before and after the implementation of the narrowing of the exemptions. Originally, before SB 277 was passed, when we look at kindergarten students in public schools in California, only 90.4% of these children were fully immunized. Children actually need a 94% threshold to be able to establish this herd immunity that's needed to protect children from passing illness from one to the other. After the bill was passed in 2017, when this same investigation was completed by our Department of Health, we actually had successfully raised the immunization rate up to 95% on average across kindergartners in public schools. So we successfully were able to achieve a community herd immunity in our community so that more children were protected from infectious diseases.
And it sounds as if California is going to take this a step further, or at least try to, with making stricter regulations or stipulations having to do with medical exemptions. Can you explain that to me?
Yes. One of the unintended consequences of the passage of SB 277 was that we saw a rise in the applications and the granting of these medical exemptions that were permitted under the current law. We saw exemption rates go from 0.2% up to 0.7% of exemptions. And what is suspected is that there were a significant number of legitimate medical exemptions, for example, to children who have autoimmune and immunological disease that really makes it unsafe for them to get vaccinations. In addition, we saw children who got exemptions where a single physician would be providing a cluster of exemptions, which is suspicious that parents were finding ways around the personal and the religious exemption and helping those exemptions to fall under the medical exemption when they may really not have qualified. So the intention of this second law, which is called SB 276, which is under consideration now, is to really narrow the medical exemption definitions and language so that we're really focusing on those children who truly have a medical illness that prevents them from getting a vaccination.
All right, Dr. Lisa Ward, thanks for updating us on the steps that California is taking on this front.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right, Dr. Ward, immediate past president of the California Academy of Family Physicians. Let's turn back to New York. Rita Palma is a parent from Bayport, Long Island, and founder of the advocacy group My Kids, My Choice. She wants New York State to keep religious exemptions. Rita, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What made you get involved and found your organization?
Well, years ago, I filed a religious exemption with my school district, and they decided to question me for a number of hours about the nature of my religious beliefs. Something that wasn't discussed by the previous guest was the fact that the objections to parents in New York are religiously based, and that's what was taken away. Not just the ability to refuse vaccines, but the ability to practice what they see is a religious belief in their system, their belief system.
So your children were able to attend public schools? I know it sounds as if they're out of public school or out of school right now.
They are. My youngest one is 19. I went through this in 06 to 08. My school district decided to give me a very hard time about my religious exemption. Ultimately, my kids stayed in school, and I came out of the whole experience thinking a parent shouldn't be treated like this. If a parent wants to exercise their belief system in raising their own children, they should be able to do that. And for many decades, parents have been able to do that in New York State.
Well, what do you say to those parents, though, that have the very seriously immune-compromised conditions their children do, that this is a life-and-death situation for them?
Well, what I would say is those children have so many more things to worry about than healthy, unvaccinated children. In fact, children with compromised immune systems take years off of going to public school for reasons other than healthy, unvaccinated children. They have to be cautious around everybody, including people with just a common cold or strep throat, for which there are no vaccines. So there are multiple concerns with those children. There is no proof, and there has never been a lawsuit, of one parent suing another because an healthy, unvaccinated children transfer disease to an immunocompromised child or any child at all. There's no study, there's no scientific study that points to healthy, unvaccinated children spreading disease any more than vaccinated children. That tagline is consensus. It's certainly not science. And I've asked, and I've never been provided, any scientific study that points to that. And if any doctor out there has one, I would love to see it. It simply doesn't exist.
So what do you see happening at the beginning of this school year, which is in just, two weeks in New York?
Right. A couple of weeks. I see parents going to school. I see parents taking their children to school. The rules and regulations are still sort of being clarified, or attempts to clarify them are being made. Things are still pretty unclear. The Department of Health just came out with new regulations about a week ago, and we're still trying to figure all of them out. But parents are going to school, especially children who are disabled and have individualized education plans and have learning needs that are unique, and parents do not feel equipped to homeschool them, or their IEP can only be fulfilled in an actual school setting. And there are many, many different services that can only be adequately provided to a child in a school setting. So the parents I'm talking to, and I'm talking to literally thousands of parents across the state, they're planning on going into school. And in fact, their superintendents are supporting them. We've had a number of superintendents step up to the plate and say, well, you know, bring your kids to school. And if we have to turn them away, stand there, hold signs that say we want to go to school. The superintendents, the administration, the Board of Education members, they are not comfortable with throwing these kids out that they have come to love and nurture. And their purpose is to educate these children. So there's a vast universe, a very diverse set of people that are very uncomfortable with how this has played out, how suddenly it was passed in New York, and the way that it was passed.
Thank you. Rita Palma from My Kids, My Choice. There are some officials in Connecticut who are calling for the state to follow New York's lead and repeal religious exemptions. Amy Dowell is one of them. Dowell is the Connecticut State Director of Democrats for Education Reform. Welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I know, Amy, you wrote an op-ed back in May calling on lawmakers to repeal the religious exemption. Why?
Well, first of all, we are an organization that care deeply about the well-being of children, first and foremost, particularly students that are vulnerable, live in poverty, et cetera. And so our instinct was that, you know, because of the dangers of not having all students vaccinated in public school, particularly the ones that are healthy and able to be vaccinated, and exposing students to infectious diseases, we feel like every student is entitled to a safe and healthy classroom. Those are the preconditions of learning, and we would like to see that be the law here in Connecticut.
And the CDC has given specific guidelines, hasn't it, for safe school immunization levels. What is that level?
So, you know, first of all, just a caveat, you know, I'm not a medical professional, but I know that 95% of a student population of a school gets the school to something called herd immunity, which means that if there are students enrolled in the school that have a legitimate medical exemption for taking a vaccine, for example, if they have a compromised immune system, for example, if they have a serious illness like cancer and they're going through chemotherapy and they can't tolerate having a vaccine or an autoimmune disorder, that they would be able to not take the vaccine and would be protected by the immunity of the community of the school once they reach that 95%. That's the recommended levels.
And there was a report, I think it's an annual report, that's done by the state's Department of Public Health on the school vaccination levels. You're a little concerned about the most recent one. Tell me about that.
Yes. Yeah. So there are over 100 schools that have reported less than a 95% immunization rate for kindergartners, and they're both public and private schools on that list, and they're all over the state of Connecticut. And having that data public and making sure that people knew about it was kind of the first step in the awareness of the fact that, you know, there have been the highest rates of measles outbreaks in our country in 27 years last year, and Connecticut should join several other states in moving towards a way of preventing students from getting sick and anybody in the community getting sick.
All right. I know you've called on the health commissioner. She's new to the state, not new to the state, but new to the role, Renee Coleman Mitchell. For her to feel free to offer an opinion on this. Has she yet, and why, if not, is she holding off on this?
So to take a step back, there were Republicans in the legislature that called upon her to not weigh in on this issue. They felt like this was an issue of civil liberties and she should not make a determination. And so it is certainly within her right to not say anything at all, but she shouldn't be restricted from doing so. And that was sort of our point, that you know, she's a public health official and she's in a position of authority and she's been charged with leading this agency and she should be able to weigh in if she can. I haven't spoken with her directly and, you know, I want to be respectful of her and her role, but I don't know. I don't know the exact reason why she's chosen not to, but we would appreciate her weighing in because we think it's a matter of health concern for students all across the state. So we just wanted to just be on the record saying that we thought it was important. She's had the opportunity to weigh in if she chooses to.
All right. Well, here the school year starts for most Connecticut schools next week. And what would you like to see lawmakers, educators, parents do to make sure that this comes down to the health, well-being, and safety of our children, this immunization level. What would you like to see all of those various groups do to make sure our kids are in safe schools?
So, you know, Connecticut offers medical exemptions and religious exemptions. And religious exemptions, you know, anybody can apply for a religious exemption in a school. They fill out a form and they are allowed to not vaccinate their child in a public school here in Connecticut. We feel that the legislature should act and repeal the religious exemption as soon as possible, so that we know that students who are enrolled in school can feel confident, particularly those with students who have a compromised immune system that cannot get the vaccine, should feel safe to send their child to school. You know, measles is so highly contagious. It can stay in the air in a room for up to 2 hours after an infected person has been in it. You know, babies are not able to be vaccinated right away. And, you know, they're going to supermarkets, they're going to public places, and we should be able to protect all children and all adults with a compromised immune system. So we hope the legislature, when they get back to session, will act on this quickly.
And what are you hearing from those that you've been speaking with? Are they more and more seeing that perhaps they want to support what you and your organization and various others are talking about?
Well, Democratic leadership in the legislature here in Connecticut have been outspoken in their support for removing the religious exemption. They have not minced words over the fact that this is a an issue of health and safety, and we would be following in the lead of, as you mentioned, New York and other states that have chosen to move on this effort.
Okay. Amy Dow, thank you for joining us today on The Full Story.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Amy Dow, Connecticut State Director of Democrats for Education Reform. And we'll continue the program after a break. This is The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran. We've been discussing the repeal of religious exemptions in New York and the impact it's having on students as they get ready to go back to school. In Connecticut, there are calls by officials to also repeal the exemptions, but for now, they're still in place. So before school begins, what do students and parents need to know about immunizations? With me now is Dr. Matt Carter. He is the state epidemiologist with the Connecticut Department of Public Health. Dr. Carter, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Doctor, tell us why immunizations have become so controversial.
Great question, and the answer is that this has been going on for quite a long time. There have been people who questioned vaccines since the very first smallpox vaccine was developed in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And really for us in this modern era, it really goes back to 1998 when there was an article published in the medical literature that claimed to associate autism with receiving the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. That article has been totally discredited. The data were fraudulent, but it started what we now call the modern vaccine hesitancy or modern anti-vaccination movement. And religious exemptions have been increasing really over the past 15 to 20 years. So this isn't a new issue for us, but what's making it new for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years was really the Disneyland outbreak in California back in late 2014, early 2015, because that showed, as was mentioned by one of your earlier speakers, that there were parts of states where there were local school districts that had lower than optimal what was called herd immunity in their school systems. And it led to transmission outside of, you know, the Disneyland theme park, which led to California's actions. But as your speaker from California mentioned, eliminating the religious exemption is not without consequences. And California has been struggling with those, was heard. And certainly from your speaker from New York is struggling with this issue as well. Here in New England, we're also looking at the state of Maine, because many folks may not be aware that Maine also eliminated the religious exemption, and for reasons that were a bit different than what was happening in New York. New York has and continues to have one of the largest outbreaks of measles in the last 25 years, and it's been going on since last October. And in part, the legislation was a response to that. In Maine, Maine has one of the highest exemption rates for about 5% religious exemption rate in Maine for children for vaccines, which is extremely high, highest in the north in New England. And so they took action because of their high exemption rate. In Connecticut, the religious exemption rate is around 2%. And overall, for measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, we have one of the highest rates in the country for kindergarten. It's over 96%. So we still have very good levels of protection overall. But as was pointed out by one of the earlier speakers, we do have schools that that have rates lower than what we would like to see. And that's what our focus on at the Department of Public Health is. What's the best way to approach this? Because how states have dealt with this in the past is, you know, actually repealing religious exemptions is one option. A second option is to actually find ways to make it more difficult, to get a religious exemption. States have tried things like, you know, requiring signatures or have it notarized. In Connecticut, all that's required is a letter. They don't even have from the parent saying that this is against my child's religious beliefs. They don't have to fill out the form that we have on our webpage. And so, all for in Connecticut, nothing has changed when it comes to this. This is an ongoing discussion. I can assure you that Commissioner Renee Coleman Mitchell will be responding to the state legislature with a full set of recommendations concerning how to improve vaccination rates in Connecticut. Fortunately, for us here in New England, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Hampshire, we have all had very high rates of vaccinations. In Connecticut, this past year, we've only had 3 cases of measles. 2 were in January and were associated with international travelers. One was in the spring and was related to the outbreak in New York City, but no further cases occurred after those cases were identified, which is, for us, means that the public health system and the medical system working together was able to stop further transmission.
Is this a situation, though, that has to be constantly monitored, considering Connecticut's proximity to New York and how transient people are and how contagious, for example, measles is? How do you monitor this on a regular basis to make sure it stays as it should in Connecticut and people are safe and healthy?
Well, measles cases are reportable to both the state and local health department in Connecticut, and that's true for every state. And any suspect case, so for example, if a child appears in an emergency department or in a doctor's office with a fever and a rash that could be consistent with measles, those calls are reportable to the state health department, usually. A physician will say, hey, I think this person might have measles, and we'll arrange for testing. But there's a very strong investigation that then goes on to identify any potential contacts or sources. Sometimes we get a really clear story that this child has fever and a rash and also was exposed to somebody who had measles. That makes it really straightforward. We then identify all of the surrounding contacts and make sure that those folks are appropriately vaccinated. And if not, we recommend they get vaccinated. Sometimes we get calls with a little less information, which is a rash and a fever, but no known contact to anyone with measles. And then we need to dig a little bit deeper to try to figure out what the possible source was. But this is the way this is right now. The world is has measles outbreaks going on in many different countries. You know, some of the measles places with measles, for example, Israel, the Ukraine, the Philippines has had outbreaks. So we get travelers, international travelers, all the time who come in and are from places where measles transmission is occurring every day. And so it's really incumbent on us to have a very strong, what we call, surveillance system to identify potential cases, contacts, make sure all the precautions are taken. That's why that concept of herd immunity or community immunity is really important, because we now have decades worth of experience that show, like for measles, for example, if you're one speaker, the earlier speaker from California said 94%, some people say 95% of the population, if you have that immunity level for school children, you can prevent further transmission. It's probably impossible for us to stop measles cases from sort of people coming in from other countries. But what our goal is to prevent outbreaks from happening, to prevent further transmission from occurring. And that's actually why the events in New York City and Rockland County, New York, have been of such concern nationwide, because this is the first time in 25 years where we've seen sustained measles transmission over time, despite all of the public health control measures that have been put in place.
Well, good luck as we get the kids back into school and back into class and cold start, and it all starts when they get into their classrooms again and the weather changes. Dr. Matt Carter, thanks for being with us today on The Full Story.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You too. Dr. Carter is the state epidemiologist with the Connecticut Department of Public Health. So why do these exemptions exist in the first place, and are they being used the way that they were meant to? Professor Dorit Rice has written about this. She is a professor of law at UC Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote a paper in which you say religious exemptions should be eliminated. Explain your theory to us.
Of course. So the basic idea behind religious exemption was that they will apply to the small minority of very small groups who have strong religious objections basically to most modern medicine. The New York religious exemption was passed in part by the influence of Christian scientists. However, you cannot limit them to those groups because our jurisprudence correctly says you can't only let groups that oppose medicine use the exemptions. You have to focus on individual beliefs. And that's really hard to police, especially if we don't want the state to step into people's soul. So you can't limit religious exemption only to organized groups that have written opposition to vaccines. You can't limit it if someone comes from a faith that supports vaccine, like Catholicism or Judaism, and say, I still have religious objections to vaccine. You can't say, well, your faith supports vaccine, so you're lying. You have to look at the individual person's sincerity. And what that means is that the people who get religious exemptions are the people who know how to say the right things, maybe because they have the resources to get legal advice, or maybe because they're better liars. I think a policy that gives exemptions to better liars, or to people with resources, isn't the right policy.
Well, so there might be those out there that would say to you, no, my religion doesn't allow for me to get these vaccinations. I practice my religion. It's important to me, the way I raise my children, my family. Therefore, I am going to opt for the religious exemption when it comes to my kids and vaccines in schools. I'm not a liar.
I will say there's probably a minority of people for whom that really is a reason. There's probably a few small groups and a few individuals who strongly believe that modern medicine, and it usually won't be just vaccines if that's their belief, that modern medicine is bad. However, we have three reasons to think that that's not the majority of people. First, studies that ask why people don't vaccinate usually point to other things, safety concerns, mistrust of government and companies, and belief in natural over medicine, all of which aren't religious concerns. Second, the fact that most religious really either support vaccines or at least don't oppose them should make us a little suspicious when people say my reasons are religious. And third, we have actually clear statements from some people online who say, I lied to get a religious exemption. I said this. And we have several sites that give you advice on how to say the right things to get a religious exemption. All this suggests that a lot of the people that apply for religious exemption are really motivated by usually misguided safety concerns about vaccines, by beliefs they received from anti-vaccine sites.
And you went through in this paper, and you went through a number of organized religions, and mm-hmm. you found that they not necessarily, even though the general belief is that they are against vaccines, but you find more times than not, they're not. Explain that to us.
That's exactly right. First of all, many of the major religions actively support vaccines, either by saying that there is a moral duty or a moral imperative to get vaccinated and protect children, or by engaging in active vaccination drives in developed countries and things like that. Even the religions you'd think would oppose, for example, Christian Science, in the 1920s, Mary Baker Eddy, who created Christian Science, wrote that if the law requires vaccines, vaccinate and pray. Basically, it's okay to vaccinate if there's a mandate. So there's no prohibition in the religion on vaccinating when there's a mandate, although they certainly don't support it. Even Jehovah's Witnesses similarly leave it to the believer. So very few religions actually prohibit vaccines.
And when it comes to religion, it comes down to a definition too, doesn't it? I mean, there's personal religious beliefs, there's spiritual beliefs. I mean, it's hard to categorize
isn't it? That's an excellent point. And our approach to religion, our legal approach, I'm not going into the philosophy because that's a little beyond me, but legally, religion isn't limited to belief in a deity. The way we define religion in our system is by looking at fundamental beliefs about matters, principled matters, the big questions. So, for example, someone who is vegan because of strong ethical beliefs and it's part of a general belief system may have a religious belief for legal purposes. On the other hand, someone who's vegan because they don't like the taste of meat or they think it's healthier wouldn't, because it's not about the big questions. So religion here really is broader than a belief in a god or attending a church. But it's not unlimited. So if your concern is, I think vaccines might be dangerous, that's not a religious argument.
And what can states do? Because you've heard it earlier in this program. Some parents believe it's my right to religious freedom. It's my decision what is best for my children. What do you say to them?
So first of all, let's separate it's my right to make decisions for my children from this is my religious belief. These aren't necessarily the same thing. I would say, first of all, as a legal matter, parental rights are never absolute. In the case of vaccine mandates, limiting parental rights both helps the child, because vaccines risk are smaller than vaccines benefit, and helps others, because we're not talking about going into the house and forcing the parents to vaccinate. We're saying if you want to send it to the school environment, which is a shared environment, you need to vaccinate before. As to the other issues, I think that one way, if a state wants to give an exemption, is not make it religious. Don't force people to lie. You want to let people get out of vaccine mandates? Make it a general personal choice exemption and make it hard to get so that it really will be limited to the extreme of the extreme who think vaccines are poison.
Well, how would you do that? I mean, is it just a longer list of questions you answer, or how would you decipher that?
So your previous caller suggested raise some of the things that states are already doing. Make it an annual exemption, not once in this child's education. Require some procedures such as notarization. In some states, we require an educational module. You can make it a somewhat longer education module, let's say a two-day course with a short quiz at the end to see if people understood. Add those procedural requirements. The choice to remove all non-medical exemption is a constitutional choice, but not all states will be comfortable with that. But if you do want to offer an exemption, I think conditioning it on religion really pushes people whose reasons are not religion to lie about why they're getting the exemption, and that's just not helpful.
And briefly, where do you see this going? Very briefly, do you see more and more states considering removing the religious exemptions?
I think it depends on where the diseases will go. If there's more diseases, yes, more states will consider. If not, I think states need the motivation to take something like this on, because it will be politically controversial.
All right. Very interesting perspective that you brought to the program today. Professor Dorit Rice has written about this. She is with UC Hastings College of Law in San Francisco. Thank you for joining us today. And thank you to all of our guests as we explored this topic. You've been listening to The Full Story. I'm Rebecca Saran.